by explaining what animal tracking is and why it's important?
Well, the whole point of the course that I took, which was the Keeping Track course from Jericho, Vermont, we were the first Quebec group to go down and do a class down there. And we actually did a couple of classes in Quebec also. And the whole idea of the thing was that you would become a citizen scientist who could report to your own community on animal use of the land. As I had mentioned to you before, you might want to know that where you're planning to build the condos is a moose breeding ground or something. And if somebody says to you, how do you know it's a moose breeding ground? You say, well, I've got 7 years worth of data and photographs. And they kind of back off at that point, you know, because we do that as a team. So it means five people have verified every single animal sign that we've recorded. And we record the GPS location, the aspect like and slope of the ground, the forest cover, the weather, all that stuff. So we have really serious data. And the Keeping Track group keeps that data and uses it to track animal populations and movements to some extent. I don't even know if the original developer of the course, Sue Morse, is still active. She was in her 70s when I took it, and that would have been, that's almost 20 years ago. She was an interesting character. She was a fourth-generation forester, a wildlife biologist with a degree in it, and a 30, 40-year hunter in Vermont's North Woods. And she had measured every track that she'd ever seen, and not just the tracks themselves, but she taught us a lot about the track patterns, so that when you can't actually see the individual tracks because, say, snow fell in when the animal lifted its paw or hoof, then you can still tell by the pattern usually what it is. And what's much more important than the step length, the stride length, is the trail width. Because an animal can do a shorter or longer step, but it can't change the width of its shoulders and hips. So you learn a lot about that. You learn things like all animals that use an alternating walking gait, like a human. How do you know where you're putting your hind foot without turning around all the time? You put it right where the front print is. So as you lift a front foot, you put the hind foot on that side right in it. And so you leave only one track per two feet. So the other thing about that, of course, is that every track you find in an alternating zigzag like that is a double. So if you want to photograph the animal's actual bare track, you're only getting the hind squished on the front there, and you've got to wait till the animal turns off or feeds or investigates something to get a solo track that you can photograph. And I have an L-shaped ruler that gives you a height and width for photographing tracks and for photographing scats. And it's very handy for identification because, again, with scats, the length of a scat doesn't really matter so much as the width, or diameter, I guess you'd call it. There's some animals that are very similar in scat diameters, like bobcat, coyote, and raccoon can be very close, being about 3/4 inch diameter and different kinds of segments. But there are differences. Coyote poop looks like dog poop, because it is. Bobcat poop looks like cat poop and smells like it. And also raccoons often rest in trees, tall trees, especially, you know, large pines or whatever. And when they come down from their sleep or whatever, they often latrine right around the base of the tree. So if you find a raccoon tree, or one that's used by raccoons, you'll often find 10 or 11 scats around the base, all different ages, fading away into the ground. And you can tell that that's a very popular raccoon tree. Anyway, the whole point of this, as I was getting to, is to know what's there and what they're doing. There are animals I didn't even know really about at all until I started doing this, like the fisher. The fisher is one of the most interesting animals to track in winter. Because you basically don't see hide nor hair of it otherwise. You don't find tracks. You might find the odd kill, but you'd never be sure what did it. But in the winter, you can follow them for miles because every single night, they cover a lot of ground and they kill a lot of stuff. The weasel family are all voracious eaters because they need to eat about, I think, almost half their body weight every day to stay alive. And a female, either pregnant or nursing, would probably need even more, up to 50% or more of her body weight every day. So they have to be very capable killers, and they'll kill way more than they need right now and come back for it later. So when a weasel of any sort gets into somebody's hen house, and kills every single chicken, people say, oh, it's evil. It's killing more than can even eat. And what they don't realize is it would come back and eat every rotten scrap eventually if it was allowed to. But of course, you find your dead chickens and you find a way to keep the fisher or whatever it is out of there. We have quite a lot of members of the weasel family, and most people don't know very much about them. The fisher is the largest terrestrial one. The next biggest would be the marten, which is much less common. I've seen small enough weasel tracks that I thought they might have been marten, but they could also have been a small fisher rather than a large marten. There's a very big difference between the male and the female in all of these species, so that a female fisher's tracks would be not that very different from a male marten, and then a female marten might not be very different from a long-tailed weasel male, and the long-tailed weasel female would be roughly the same size as the short-tailed weasel or ermine male. So you really, if you want to get finicky, you can measure the track width and the length of the actual track, the foot itself. And sometimes you can get at least a clear idea that this is out of the range for other things and therefore must be such and such. But that's one of the only ways you can tell. However, following fishers backwards, by the way, we follow everything backwards just to respect the animal and not freak it out. If they come back on their tracks and find your tracks following them, they know you're following. If you're going the other way, they don't seem to worry so much. And tracking them backwards, you find out everything they do naturally rather than what they do when a human is following them. And you're never usually going to be close enough to the animal for your behavior to affect its behavior. But still, if you want to learn about the animal's natural behavior, always track it backwards. And you'll find kills, you'll find places where they lay up, places where they poop and pee to mark territory. Usually, among a lot of the wild animals, a male's territory will overlap that of several females. And so there's a big competition to see who's going to get all of them pregnant every year. And that leads to not just territorial marking, but territorial, I guess, what would you call it? Not warfare, just competition, heavy competition. Oh, yeah? No, this is my territory. No, it's my territory. One of the things they've observed with birds, which sing to mark their territory, is that a bird that's already staked out a territory will always fight harder to keep it than an intruder will fight to get it. The idea being that it's got something to protect, whereas the intruder is just trying his luck. And I don't know how much that goes for some of the other animals around here, but certainly they all mark their territory with pee and poop, with bites and scratches on trees. Bears are big on that. They'll take a bite out of a red pine and rub their back fur into it. So you find a huge chunk taken out of the bark, the sap running, and the sap full of bear hair. And if it's old enough, of course, it's been bleached to white in the sun, but you can still know that it's bear hair because only a bear could bite out that big chunk at that height. They'll also bite and scratch paper birch just because they show the mark so much. So that's another territorial mark. But the more usual territorial mark for a bear is you'll find their poops and their prints. And their prints you really only find in summer, although I've been lucky enough in the change of season to occasionally get them in snow. But as you know, they tend to not exactly hibernate, but spend the whole winter in a den. And so you don't really find their prints in snow very much.
Could you tell us when the best time to go tracking is?
Well, the winter. I kind of feel every winter like that's my season, and oh boy, here we go again. And the other day, actually, I was on my mom's lawn right here in Knowlton, and I saw an animal sign I'd never seen before. I had one time in January found a female coyote pee, and you can tell the female from the male because it's straight down in the middle of the trail and not sprayed to the side, and it was reddish-orange. And I looked up in my nature books, found out that that was about the time that coyotes were in estrus. So the other day I found a deer in estrus pee on the lawn right in the middle of all these deer prints. So here we go, a deer in estrus. And of course, they're just finishing their season. Let's see. Raccoons are easy to figure out from their tracks because they waddle so heavily and roll with it that they end up planting their hind foot beside the other front foot. So instead of finding a track, as I mentioned, when animals alternate, they put the hind foot where the front foot was. The raccoon's not necessarily doing that. What you'll find is the smaller front print beside the larger hind print, and then the reverse, the hind and the front, and then the front and the hind and the front. So it's sort of a changing gait, and the track looks very busy because they step quite short. So there's a lot of tracks in whatever length of trail, whereas other animals would either have longer legs or a narrower trail width for that kind of coverage. So raccoons are pretty easy, and also if the tracks go to a muddy spot during a melt in the winter, it's almost certainly a raccoon because that's where they go scavenging. They don't hibernate either, but they're torpid and sleepy all winter, and they'll really only come out if there's a thaw. So we don't have a lot of serious hibernators around here, except perhaps the chipmunk and groundhog, since bears don't really hibernate. Some of the squirrels do, but not the red squirrel. It's active all winter. I don't think the gray squirrels even hibernate. I think they just are less active in winter, although they would have sources of food probably all year.
Perfect. Okay. You're a wealth of knowledge.